When it comes to teaching kids and teens about money, practice makes perfect. That's where Greenlight comes in. With a debit card and money app of their own, kids learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. Parents send instant money transfers, create custom chores, and automate allowance, while kids track their spending, set savings goals, and practice money skills they can use today and for life. Get 1 month free when you sign up at greenlight.com/podcast.
Welcome to Teacher Quit Talk. I'm Miss Redacted.
And I'm Mrs. Frazzled. Every week we explore the teacher exodus to find out what, if anything, could get these educators back in the classroom.
We've all had our moments where we thought, what the hell am I doing here? From burnout to bureaucracy to soul-sucking stressors and creative dead ends.
From recognizing when it was time to go to navigating feelings of guilt and regret afterwards, we're here to cut out the gaslighting and get real about what it means to leave teaching.
We've got insights from former teachers from all over the country who have seen it all. So get ready to be disturbed. Join us on Teacher Quit Talk to laugh through the pain of the U.S. education system. We'll see you there.
Hi, I'm Frances Callier.
And I'm Angela V. Shelton.
And we're Frangela.
You know what you need in your life? The Final Word podcast.
Yes, you do.
That's right. It is the final word on all things political and pop cultural.
Where we make real news real funny.
Where we inspire you so you can hashtag resist.
Subscribe and get a new episode of the Final Word podcast each week. It's the news we think you need to hear.
That's right. We think you need to hear it. Okay.
Yeah, it's what we say so.
That's right. And because all we do is give, every Thursday you can listen to our hysterical podcast, Idiot of the Week.
We round up the stupid because you know what? Somebody has to.
Okay. All we do is give.
Дамы и господа, это Prevail. И ваш ведущий Грег Олиер.
I'm Greg Oliar. This is Prevail. Welcome to the program. We've got a great show. Jen Taub is here. She is the author of Big Dirty Money, The Shocking Injustice and Unseen Cost of White Collar Crime. I followed her on the Twitter for a long time. She's at Jen Taub, J-E-N-T-A-U-B. And she's terrific. We had a really good discussion. And even though a lot of it was kind of heavy and I guess maybe a little bit depressing, we did have a good time. We did laugh a little bit. And that was fun. So I'm excited to share that with you. That's coming in just a minute. This week, I'm proud of myself because I actually did journalism this week. I did. My columns at Prevail are really not technically journalism. It's more news analysis, which is slightly different. Journalism, per se, is when you're basically trying to break news. You're trying to learn things. You're trying to pump sources for information and then report on stuff that people don't already know. What I do is more taking the stuff that the journalists pump out and weaving it together and analyzing it and creating a narrative so that people can digest it in a big picture way, which is not exactly the same thing. Anyway, important distinction. But this week I did do actual journalism when I found out that Amy Coney Barrett, the new Supreme Court justice and handmaiden in People of Praise, when she got her $2 million advance book deal from Sentinel, which is a imprint of Penguin Random House that publishes these conservative books by Brian Kilmeade and that asshole from Toronto who hates women, Jordan Peterson, people like that. That's what the imprint cranks out. I reached out to the editorial director because she, you know, her email is on there, her Twitter handle's on there, and I reached out on Twitter and on email asking questions about how this advance came about, what the thinking process was. I asked about 5 questions and I didn't hear back. So I was able to write in my piece. I asked and there was no response. So, you know, you read that sometimes in a news story and it's always kind of fun because it's a something you do at the end, in my understanding. You know, you get all the information and then you call for a comment. And often there is, they could not be reached for comment, or they declined to comment, or they did not respond to questions, or that kind of thing. And it's always, it's kind of a little bit of a, yeah, I did my job, and you failed to even defend yourself. So anyway, it's a good piece, I think. I think it's one of my better ones. And I delve into the publishing politics kind of Bermuda Triangle of, you know, money going from point A to point B. Because what happens is these people get these big advances And then the books get sold, and they do get sold. But a lot of those copies wind up getting bought by special interest groups like Republican PACs and organizations and Turning Point USA. Charlie Kirk's group, according to the New York Times, bought a whole bunch of Don Jr.'s masterpiece, Triggered. Now, as a writer, this really bothers me because there's all of these copies of the book. It's changing hands. It's getting paid for. Then it's going out and these groups give it away to donors and stuff like that. But who the fuck is reading this stuff? Like, who really is reading Triggered by Don Jr. other than the people unfortunate enough to be tasked with reviewing it? And I don't know, maybe somebody like me out of morbid curiosity. Like, I know he has kind of more of an audience than other people do. There's a lot of these, you know, mouth-breathing incels really like that guy. But are the mouth-breathing incels really going to the store and buying the book and then reading it? I would be shocked that that many people actually read the whole damn thing from cover to cover. Kimberly Guilfoyle was helping him promote it. I bet she didn't read it. Doesn't seem like something that she would want to do. I don't know. Is it in her deal? Is it in the deal she negotiated to be his friend? I don't know. Maybe there isn't really a deal for her to be his friend, but it sure seems like there is. Sure seems like there is. So as a writer and somebody who produces books that people do read and do enjoy and do get something out of, I think my novels didn't sell boffo box office, but the people that read them certainly liked them. And same thing with Dirty Rubles. I mean, people read it who bought it. And that's what you want as a writer. You know, the money part is nice, but what you really want is an audience. You want people to read what you're saying, what you're writing. You want your voice to be heard. So what's the fucking point of this? It's a game in a sense. Amy Coney Barrett is probably not going to write this book. She's going to get paid. If the advance is $2 million, she's got to give 15% of that probably to her agent. And she's probably going to pay about $100,000, give or take, for somebody else to write that book, to ghostwrite it, which is great. Ghostwriting is great. It's a wonderful thing. It's a great way for writers to make money. But let's not make any bones about it. She ain't going to write the fucking book, almost certainly. So you're paying for a book by her that isn't really by her. Maybe she has some input in it. I don't know how this stuff works, but it's not really an authentic article. And what the heck does she even have to say? She's been there for a couple months and basically distinguished herself by not wearing masks at her little coming out party there where everybody got infected that wound up going. Great, Amy, including her kids who were maskless at that event, by being a handmaiden in this People of Praise, let's call it what it is, a cult. And then there's all these things about, oh, she has to obey the husband and this and that. I don't understand how that works. If the book is about how she needs to obey her husband, maybe I'd read it. But I don't think it's going to be about that. Like, she hasn't written enough, like, case stuff to even write it. But it's very strange, this whole thing. So, and yet, it will be a bestseller. It'll be at the box stores. Her creepy stare will be fixed on us as we walk by the end caps at Target and whatever. And there she will be. And she'll have her $2 million. Or, you know, less taxes, less agent fee, less whatever she pays the ghostwriter, which is a lot of money, you know? And yeah, she needs a lot of money. She's entitled to write a book. That's not the point. The point is, let her write the book and let her actually take home the actual royalties. I don't know that she's going to make the advance back. And then we're just giving a sitting Supreme Court justice $2 million, which seems crazy to me. Because you don't have to give the advance back. In the music business, these bands, you see this, the band goes on tour and they're trashing hotel rooms and all this stuff. And the record companies just have their spreadsheets out, their abacuses, and they're keeping close tabs on how much the band spends. And they are billed for everything. And if they don't make back that advance with the sales, that's it. They're done. They're in debt and it sucks. The book business doesn't work like that. You do not ever have to pay back your advance. So the trick, if you're an editor and trying to negotiate the advance, is to make the advance something that you think the book is actually going to get back. Because the editor wants the writer to be paid, the author to be paid. But the editor also wants to make money for the company and the concern so that everybody wins, right? When the advances aren't won back, it's kind of it's not so great for the bottom line. So a $2 million advance is just batshit and optically awful. It just looks awful. It looks like she's getting paid off. It looks like a cleaned up, more presentable version of Kavanaugh's baseball tickets. And that's what it fucking looks like to me. So we basically right now, as I see it, we have two owned justices on the Supreme Court. Hooray. That's just wonderful. And it doesn't do anything to give us faith in the rule of law. And that's the thing that hurts the most. That's the thing that you know, is the biggest problem here. The rule of law, man. We need the rule of law. When we can't trust the Supreme Court, and she's now ruling on some case concerning a group that spent $1 million to get her nominated, that that invested in advertising and PR for her nomination. That's that Koch brothers, Americans for Prosperity, whatever the fuck it is. How can she not recuse herself? But she's not going to recuse herself. Everybody's afraid of abortion and that kind of thing, but it's this shit. It's this dark money shit. That's why Kavanaugh and Coney Barrett and Gorsuch and Roberts and Thomas, and that's why they're there. They're there for this. They're there to give more power to the rich and powerful. That's why they're there at the end of the day. All the other stuff is noise. It really is. So that's the thing we have to keep our eye on. And that's why I'm so excited to have Jen Taub here, because she knows a little bit about big, dirty money. Before we get to her, we're going to take a quick interlude. My friend Rich Ferguson, who is a wonderful spoken word artist, sent me this great spoken word poem called Autopsy of a Democracy. So we're going to cut to Rich doing a dramatic reading, spoken word of that. He's really great. If you ever get the chance to see him live, he's terrific. Rich Ferguson. He's going to do that. And then we'll be right back with Jen Taub.
Upon reviewing the autopsy of democracy, will you mention that it died a slow, protracted death? Will you reveal that its stomach was riddled with cruelty, its intestines marred with embezzlement, its esophagus savage with lies? Will you overlook the fact that its body committed many racist acts, but was continually found innocent by a jury of its peers? Upon reviewing the autopsy of democracy, ask yourself if the corpse resembles a black body swinging from a tree. Ask yourself if the noose marks around its neck will preclude it from an open casket ceremony.
Okay, I'm very excited for today. I'm joined by Jennifer Taub, author of Big Dirty Money, The Shocking Injustice and Unseen Cost of White Collar Crime. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Greg.
You're holding the book up, but this is audio only. It's only audio. I have mine. I have mine right here too. otherwise, I'd have my good camera on.
Picture if you're at home listening.
Or I'll screenshot it. I'll screenshot it.
So that's okay, but they can picture it kind of forest green, money color. No, it's fine.
It's. I love the book. It's really good, and I've been talking about it on various podcasts since I read the first half of it, like when it came out, and then I read the second half of it recently, because there's just so much in there that's good. But I think the triumph of it is that you managed to take something really complicated and explain it in a way that people can understand. It's not one of these egghead things where you're stopping and going to the dictionary every third word and you're lost in the minutia. It's really well laid out, well written, but written in such a way that I think is really easy to understand. So good job on you.
Yeah. I appreciate that. Just a comment on style. I mean, I think it's sometimes hard to do, but I remember with my first book, my editor at the time told me to write the book you want to read, right? And so I'm often taking something a topic that people may generally know something about, or I might, and I want to dig in really deeply into the details, but then I realize I don't want to bore everybody. That's not the book I'd want to read. So I try to lay it out that way.
You did a great job, because I feel like also I could give this book to a high school kid. I mean, the high school kids in my house don't read books, but a high school kid that in a hypothetical world would read a book would be able to read your book, I think, really easily and get a lot out of it. So my first question, and I have a bunch of questions, what was the impetus for this book specifically? What drove you to write it?
It was kind of an unanswered question. When my first book came out, Other People's Houses, about the big 2008 financial crisis, I did a similar thing that we were describing. I took a topic that people knew something about, but I felt like not enough. And I wanted to pull back. You know how like behind the wall of your house, there's an electrical outlet you plug stuff in, and we don't think much about the wiring. I wanted to kind of pull back the wall and look at the wiring that led this, you know, house to go up in flames. And I did that in this book. And it was mostly trying to look at kind of the history of the fraud and why people lost their homes and try to look at the legal changes that caused that in a way, in a narrative structure that people would want to read. And the other, as I was writing it, I found out that there was a big, I thought a big parallels between this big savings and loan debacle that happened in the 80s that most readers had forgotten about. And not just similarities in terms of the fraud that went on, but similarities in terms of the laws that were set out that led to the savings and loan meltdown, similar to the bank collapse and the mortgage crisis. So I write this book, and it was really hard because it's, you know, your first book, you're hoping you're going to finish it, and it's agonizing. And I was glad when it was done. And the first day, when the day of the book launch, I was at my wonderful local bookstore, Broadside Books in Northampton. And that was the days when you actually saw people in bookstores and ate food off the same, you know, crackers off the same plate and such. And the very first question I did, you know, a little reading, there's a little Q&A from Roxy at the bookstore. And then someone raises their hand. And the first thing they said is, why did no bankers go to jail? And I'm like, am I allowed to swear on this podcast?
Oh, please do. Yeah.
I'm like, shit. You're right. Why the fuck didn't they go to jail? No, but I didn't say it like that. I tried to say, well, good question. But, you know, I'm a very inquisitive person. And it's not okay for me to say good question. Like I wanted a better answer to that question. And my friend, Jesse Eisinger, wrote a book that tackled that topic called The Chicken Shit Club. He's a wonderful reporter for ProPublica. I think he had some theories, and I wanted though to do what I do, which is try to look at some of the legal issues, right? Because people were saying, why do white collar criminals always get away with it? And I taught a course on white collar crime. And then I eventually joined a casebook on white collar crime. But I felt, if you can believe this, that I didn't even know what white collar crime was. And this is where I get into the weeds. I'm like, wait a second. I find out as I dig deeper that there's nobody in the U.S., not the FBI, not local governments, not even the Department of Justice, that actually has a shared definition of what they mean by white collar crime. And they don't even count it properly. Anyway, so long story made short, the main reason why I wrote this book is I didn't really fully understand why no bankers went to jail. That became this bigger book, which is why do very few white collar criminals and corporate criminal entities get caught, get charged, get prosecuted, get convicted, and even pay meaningful fines or go to jail. It became this sort of bigger topic. That's one answer. And the second answer was, I haven't told anyone this, but I really initially pitched a book on the Mueller report. I really wanted to write a book about, it was called Beyond Mueller Mania. Okay. But my wise agent and editor, and you know, when I was pitching this in March of 2019, had a feeling that by the time the book came out, a year later, maybe that wouldn't be the topic. And they said, don't you know a lot about white collar crime? And I said, well, sure. So yeah, I mean, so then I decided maybe I should pitch that book, and that worked.
Yeah, I think it did. And in this book, you wouldn't have Bill Barr going out and lying about what the contents contain. You know, the book is just fine. There's nothing wrong with white collar crime. Now, I was going to ask you about.
I'd love if he did, though. That would have been really good for sales.
I know. Okay, I'm gonna read passages from the book and then ask you about them. Since you brought this up, I was going to ask you about white collar crime, but you mentioned this in your responses, and so I'm just reading this passage. Okay. From the preface, white-collar crime in America, such as fraud and embezzlement, cost victims an estimated $300 billion to $800 billion per year. Yet street-level property crimes, including burglary, larceny, and theft, cost us far less, around $16 billion annually, according to the FBI. But we cannot know the full extent of white-collar crime, as the FBI does not report an annual total. Really. In fact, there is no government agency that measures and reports full white-collar crime statistics, not on an annual basis, not even on a regular basis. Individual private researchers try to piece it all together. Think about that again. No one at all actually measures or knows the amount of cost of white-collar crime in the United States. How can we possibly do this podcast without swearing? What the fuck is up with that? So,
no, it's so funny because some people think, well, if you're a lawyer or you're a writer, you must just be a humanities person and you don't care about numbers. Well, they don't know me. Like I was more, you know, I'm more of actually a quantitative person and I like words too, right? And so fundamentally, how do you define, there's an expression in business, you can't manage what you don't measure, right? And for me in writing, how do you talk about something you can't define? Define the field first. And this was very funny to me. But it makes a lot of sense if you, for those readers who look into this, it's not a terrible plot. It's not like there's, you know, that Greg and I could like look out the window and say, there it is, and they're ignoring it. It's just that we don't share a definition of what we're talking about. And even if we decided, okay, these particular categories of crimes or offenses qualify under the rubric, there still isn't that measurement happening for a number of reasons. So anyway, I find that utterly fascinating. And I think one of the reasons why I wanted to start with measurement is I could imagine a skeptical person. I think as a writer, you carry that skeptical person in your brain saying, well, how much crime is there? Why are you writing a book about this? You know, it's a threshold question. And then when you can't answer that, it's like, I could have just been like, oh, I guess I can't write this book. But I think the book still works anyway, because then you can try to zero in on types of behavior and types of people who would be considered white collar criminals.
Now I have it on my question to ask, what is white collar crime? And so we're going to skip that because I'm going to ask about Edwin Sullivan in a second, because he's interesting. But, before we get started into the weeds here, why is it bad? I mean, why should we care? I know the answer to this, but I want to ask it because I think it's really important. And I think it's something people don't think about and they don't really process why it's bad. So why is white collar crime so bad? What's the big deal?
So I guess I'll give a few different reasons. One reason why undetected white collar crime is bad is because there are victims out there. And there are victims who could have not been victims if we stop people from predatory white collar crime behavior. And for the sake of discussion here, let's imagine we're talking about fraud mostly as white collar crime, tricking. And the way I would define fraud for you for this podcast is think of fraud as tricking someone or deceiving someone in order to get their money or something of value from them. Or think of white collar crime as any of the big environmental crimes or anything like food and drug crimes like the Sackler family's, maybe it's not been called criminal, the Sackler family's involvement with Purdue Pharma. So that's what I would consider white collar corporate crime. And so when we don't detect it early on, if you just look at Purdue Pharma, we have people becoming heavily addicted to prescription opioids and dying and crimes in communities. So part of it is to avoid victims that would not have been victims. That's one reason. Second reason begins with something we were talking about, which is, and I don't remember if we talked about this before you went live or right after you went live. I think it was before you went live, but it was just reported in some testimony before Congress, the head of the Internal Revenue Service saying there's, you know, almost $1 trillion of uncollected taxes every year that they can't collect because they don't have enough people. It's called the tax gap. It used to be around $800 billion every year. We can get to that. So one reason is it costs us money. One of the biggest types of white collar crime is tax fraud. That's what we call not paying your taxes deliberately. And then the third reason, which is the one I think people don't think about, which I wanted to emphasize and bring to the center of the discussion of the book, is it exacerbates class and income inequality.
Yes.
If you have the extremely wealthy and well-connected can cut corners and cheat and commit tax fraud and do these kinds of things just to get rich and richer. What they do is they become wealthy and powerful on crime, and that crime allows them to become more and more rich. And so then we just the problems we already have with the billionaire and multimillionaire class and the rest of us becomes worse. And I guess the fourth reason, which is obvious, is either we have a rule of law or we don't. No one is above the law, and it undermines our faith in our institutions and in the society when you have some people not playing by the rules. Those are my four reasons.
Those are four very compelling reasons. All of them great. I mean, $1 trillion a year. This is a tweet from the day that we're taping this, which will be, you know, a while before it actually runs, but tax cheats are costing the U.S. $1 trillion a year, according to the IRS. In the Wall Street Journal, this is reported. That's a lot of money. I mean, everybody, the Republicans especially, like to talk about how we can't afford this and we can't afford that. And we're the only big money country in the world that doesn't have a universal health care plan. How can we pay for it? Well, the answer is collect the taxes that people owe and use the taxes that people are supposed to pay for this stuff. And then the other point you bring up, I was going to ask later, and we'll get to later because I want to talk about sentencing and the disparity in sentencing. But this is one of those institutional racist things that's baked into the system that people don't talk about or don't think of when they think about racism, that the white collar crimes are disproportionately rich white guys and the other crimes are not. And the punishments meted out have no basis in reality when you're trying to figure out how to adjudicate or punish somebody who's done who's selling loose cigarettes on the street in New York City versus somebody who has bilked investors out of millions of dollars or whatever it happens to be.
Yeah, I just, you know, speaking of tweets and you're reading them, there's something today that has been clicking in my mind, and I wish I had thought about it, and maybe I'll put it in the in the book now that I'm working on some changes or the new epilogue for the paperback. But in the book, what I do talk about, and you're talking about the racialized and the racist notions and behavior embedded in how laws are constructed and enforced. The one thing I talk about is you mentioned loose cigarettes, Eric Garner. That his selling loose cigarettes is an economic offense. He was accused of a kind of tax fraud, tax evasion, because he was selling cigarettes that came from out of state, and therefore the New York City and New York State tax authorities were, you know, being cheated out of their due for these cigarettes. And in the book, I say, you know, can you imagine, you know, myself, a white woman, if I were dropping my tax returns off in a post office box and they thought that they were fraudulent because they had like a wire on me, I don't know why this would, they would, but, and they thought they knew, and can you imagine the cops coming up to the, you know, hanging out at the post office, circling me, tackling, and while I do, and I have asthma, me saying I can't breathe and them killing me, and everybody like, well, she was a tax cheat. I mean, with that, and the thing is, this is what, you know, the reason why they did not prosecute, they just said to drop charges, federal charges, and then I think later state, but federal charges against the cop who killed Eric Garner was because they said it wasn't, they didn't think a jury would believe that was unreasonable force. But take my hypothetical.
Yeah.
If they start tackling and killing white ladies at the post box, is that going to be considered unreasonable force? I mean, God forbid, maybe people would wake up. But the thing I wish I had talked about in the book, was police officers who are armed making traffic stops for technical violations. I mean, we can see what we saw in the news this week is Dante Wright, a young black man, 20 or 21 years old, in Minneapolis, being pulled over because he didn't have an updated license plate or something when everyone's running behind. You know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
Running behind it. So first of all, you know, we're so used to it. We're so used to this one piece that if your taillight is out, or if you have an expired registration, the police pull you over. Police who are armed, those armed police. What the worst thing that happens to me is if that happens is I get a ticket. The best thing is I smile and they don't do anything, right? Yeah. Oh, sorry. Okay, that's my life as a white woman. But we've seen so many of those police encounters turn into murders and turn into killings. In the case of Dante Wright, we have he was killed by a police officer who claims that she thought she was shooting a taser. And that encounter should never have happened. Why do we have armed law enforcement doing that? And someone might say, well, we do that because if we didn't have anyone enforce the law, then no one would bother to get their inspection stickers. Well, there's a better way to deal with that system other than people with guns if that ends up killing people all the time. And for God's sake, we pulled off was it Johnson & Johnson's COVID vaccine because six people out of millions got blood clots and they pulled off the market, check it out. We have time after time after time police encounter with black people, involving guns and also and people ending up dead. So I think that we've got to really rethink this. And here's what the tweet that I want to tell you. And I like to use white collar crime to show the racism in the regular criminal justice system. So I said, you know, can you imagine armed police doing elevator inspections in corporate office buildings? You know, the elevator inspection, it's always out of date, right? Mm-hmm. It's always like you're in the elevator, you see the inspection thing and you're like, it hasn't been inspected in a year. And you pray you're not the person. Does this happen to you? And you think, if I'm shut in this elevator, do I have like a energy bar in my bag and some water? Will I live? Anyway, but can you imagine armed police doing elevator inspections in corporate office buildings or high-end luxury apartments and just taking that moment to search around to see if any white-collar crime or any crime is committed? Can you imagine them saying, oh, I'm sorry, I was in the building. I just happened to see this, you know, this white teenage kid with, you know, a joint in their hand. Or I was just checking the elevator. And while we were here, we just noticed you were acting suspicious. The accountant was acting suspicious. The next thing we know, they've taken some corporate office documents. I mean, we don't allow that for a certain class of people, including people who could be committing tax fraud. But we allow armed police to just pull people over on the street and create these encounters. So again, you know, why do we have armed people confronting people for small things? And anyway, that to me, that's a lot about how this, how our mindset needs to change.
That's almost mob stuff in a sense. If you, I mean, not, I guess, you know, it's lawful eye roll, but they're doing that to get revenue. That's why they're doing it. So, you know, it's a troll on the bridge at that point. You're not a cop. You're a troll on the bridge. If you're speeding.
Like a Michael Brown situation, like in St. Louis, where the counties are making money on all the tickets. Yeah.
It's one thing. Look, if you're speeding, I'm a guy who, when I drive, I'm constantly shouting it. Like, where are the cops? Where are the cops? Arrest this guy. Arrest that guy. Because somebody's always passing me on the right doing 120 miles an hour.
Right.
And this and that. And they never. That's it's never. Yeah, that's different. That somebody can die from that.
Someone who's speeding or driving, weaving in through lanes, they're creating danger. Someone the other situations, a taillight is out, let them find that out at an inspection, or let them, maybe someone who's not armed should be at gas station saying, hey, do you know your taillight is out? I'll sell you a new taillight or something, make it a business, you know.
Or just take a picture of the license plate, figure out my email from EasyPass and send me a notice.
Right.
You know, there's plenty of anything that's automated like that, like an inspection sticker, can very easily be
exactly just like
they should know.
Toll booths. There's no more toll booths. Those were a big boon.
They have these workarounds. So yes, that's a good point though, because I didn't think about it like the elevator guys. And it's natural. It's a natural tendency to get nervous when these people are around, because why do you have to have a gun here and there? There was another thing I saw this week that really struck me. I can't watch the trials because it's so upsetting.
Right.
But there was a list, I think it was in the Washington Post, that listed people who died in accidents on their jobs. And cops are like way below taxi drivers and construction workers. So this idea that they're going into danger, yes, being a policeman is obviously more dangerous than being a writer, for example, or a college professor or whatever, but it's not more dangerous than a lot of other jobs, starting with sex workers, which is by far the most, far, you know. And the cops, do they protect the sex workers or are they harassing them most of the time? Yeah, rhetorical question. Yeah, it's not good. It's creepy.
Yeah, I do think, but just to be clear, like, I think I'm not someone who's a police abolitionist, but I'm someone who believes we need to completely rethink and refund the way policing happens. I would do things completely differently, you know, and even the conversation, you know, especially around things like property theft, you know, with what happened in Minnesota in reaction to the killing I was just telling you about, of the young man who was pulled over because his plate, or not his plate, but I think his inspection, whatever it was out of date. And then it turns out there was a warrant out for him. I just read that maybe they had sent the warrant to the wrong address for this misdemeanor and all this stuff. If we rethought policing, I think that, oh, right. So there are people protesting and then people looting stores. And it's like, everyone gets so upset, but why are people stealing things? Maybe people are stealing things because they don't have enough money. Like, if we had better job programs and we dealt with that, we wouldn't have that situation. Also, stores can have pay for their own guards and security, and they don't need to be armed. There's a way you could manage this without without giving threatening the lives of people over property loss.
Yeah, it's a recipe for disaster is what we've seen, I think.
And just for the property loss thing, everyone's, you know, flipped out because there's property damage and people having stuff stolen, you know, from these stores. And again, I don't want buildings burning. I don't like property. You know, I like people to behave, and I like having markets and goods and services and everything.
Okay, you're anti-riot. We get it.
But the idea of this whole, you know, looters should be shot on sight. I mean, for God's sake, you know, Donald Trump, you know, had a fake university and paid a $25 million settlement after he was already elected president. No one says, well, that fraudster should be shot on sight.
Well, people might, but
they shouldn't.
No, and they should not. Okay, I want to read another passage from your book now, because it goes, we didn't talk about Edwin Sullivan, but we'll get back to that, because over in Iceland, as of 2018, judges have sent 36 bankers to jail in connection with the 2008 crash of the Icelandic banking system. Prison sentences of 96 years in total. The convictions were at the highest level, including several top bank executives and the former CEO of a giant international bank in Reykjavik, who was sentenced to 7 years in prison for financial crimes related to the crisis. Instead, in the United States, while a few notable CEOs of failed giant banks paid civil penalties to settle with federal regulators, they were never criminally prosecuted. And this speaks to what you were saying just now, which is we have armed cops trying to shoot looters in the streets, and yet these other crimes, which arguably are much worse and affect lots more people and are absolutely tearing apart the underpinnings of society, they get away scot-free. So the answer maybe isn't about defunding the police. The answer is allocating how the resources of police work go and reallocating what they're working on. We don't need the police to tell us, like you said, if our taillight is out. We need the police to investigate crimes. That's what we need. Serious crimes, and the more serious, the more that we need the cops. Otherwise, it's a goddamn free-for-all.
Yeah, I mean, we need the one of the suggestions I make in the book is that we need the FBI and we need a dedicated unit within the Department of Justice, including FBI and U.S. attorneys, who are focused on big money crime. And I'm calling it big money crime because I don't want to always use white collar crime, because I deliberately, for that division, think that we need to think more about not just the nature of the offense, fraud type behavior, but also the status of the actor. You know, it's really just like you're talking about a revenue generating thing. You pull someone over, you give them a ticket, you make money. You know, someone has a parking ticket, you make money. They don't pay the ticket, you make more money, because et cetera, et cetera. That whole scheme, you know, that sort of small potato, so you can count up how many things that you've done, but never take on people with real power, happens at the federal level, not just at the parking ticket or, you know, someone over in your cop car level. And I think that's a big problem. And we can change that only if we reallocate resources to do it. Just like the guy from the IRS, you know, going back to that, there was billions of dollars of cuts and numerous tens of thousands of people who lost their job over the last 10 years at the Internal Revenue Service. So of course they're not collecting, and they're also not going after the most difficult cases, because, you know, it's just how incentives and priorities work. If you're being hired and you're working on a tax case, collection case, and it takes you, you know, 8 months, 2 years, 3 years, it doesn't even matter if your boss is complaining. You feel bad if the person next to you has closed, you know, 50 different cases in that time frame. Even if they've collected less money, even if they're just shaking down people who can barely get by, they've done their job. And we need to keep it, have, you know, you need a separate unit that handles that. And my analogy to this is, you know, having worked in the business sector, you know, if you were, you know, when I worked at, and they're a perfectly good company, they're not a white collar company, but I'm using this as an analogy. When I worked at Fidelity Investments, right, they're a huge money management firm, and they had people called relationship managers, right? Because Fidelity Investment, you know, can do retail business where I could, you know, personally buy a mutual fund, you know, with my savings, Or the way they get a lot of customers is they get their mutual funds sold through a corporation's 401k retirement plan. They're on the menu of the retirement plan. So a relationship manager is going to be someone who makes sure you play nice with Coca-Cola. I don't know if they're on their plan or all the big companies, because, you know, when you get one company, you suddenly have 20,000 accounts, right? This is how business works. We could talk about the same thing happening if you were in the garment district. You really want Walmart to be buying your stuff because they're a big customer. Right. You're smiling. Or maybe you don't because they squeeze the hell out of the margins. I don't know. But so the idea that we would be stupid in the government level and not focus on where the money is, where the really good returns are. Yeah, you still need to have, you still want to have retail customers, right? You still want to, because if you don't have retail customers, it's part of your branding. It also, there's reasons why. We still want ordinary people to pay their taxes, but why are we putting the emphasis there? And in fact, we know, well, anyway, we really want to put the emphasis at the top. But then, you know, of course, we have the problems of the way the very wealthy businesses have manipulated politicians so they don't even have to pay much in taxes, right? It goes hand in hand. The $1 trillion is just what's owed. It's uncollected.
Right. Yeah,
there's a lot more that they don't have to pay because of this ridiculous, you know, Trump tax law that cut corporate tax, et cetera.
Doesn't Robert Mercer owe the IRS like $6 billion or some ridiculous amount of money?
You know, yeah, I mean, I've read things like that. But yeah, the question is, why is no one going after that?
And that seems like it might be worth, you know, throwing a couple guys at, you know, put some people on that stat. Now, the real reason that the...
Right, as we're talking about this, wouldn't it be fun if they hired us both over at the IRS? Okay, let's get this going. What's going on with this?
I'm there. I'll do the social media. No, the real reason that no taxes have been collected for these years is because literally every single person at the IRS has been involved with Trump's audit. That's got to be the answer. So, all right, I always forget to do this. And then I have to interrupt in the middle of a recording. So I'm going to say now, we're going to take a break on the show, and we'll be right back with Jennifer Taub.
This is Nunzio Ciccarelli, president of the Banca da Bada Bing, the best financial services firm in Jersey. The situation got you up at night? Bada Bing got your back. Afraid your CPA will sing like a soprano? We'll make sure he goes through some things. Worried about some rival Goomba stealing your crypto wallet? Bada Bing offers the best security this side of Le Havre. Remember, I'm not just the bank of the Bada Bing president. I'm also a client. Bank of the Bada Bing. Member FDIC my ass. And now, back to the show.
Okay, we're back with Jennifer Taub, author of Big Dirty Money, The Shocking Injustice and Unseen Cost of White Collar Crime. Now, on part two of our discussion, I want to talk about lawyers, because it's time. We mentioned up top Edwin Sutherland, who is you write about him a lot at the beginning of the book, and he's somebody who really kind of pioneered the thinking about white collar crime. But he has a great quote in here, and I've said this on so many podcasts, and I just think it's brilliant. So this is on page 8 of your book. In a pithy aside, Sutherland found an interesting distinction between the two classes. And these are the two classes of criminals. The inventive geniuses for the lower class criminals are generally professional criminals, while the inventive geniuses for many kinds of white collar crime are generally lawyers. Reader, this lawyer agrees. So I love that so much. I can't even... Now,
my homage to is it Jane Austen, Reader, I Married Him, or is it a Bronte who says that? I don't remember.
I don't call me Ishmael. No. What's the deal with lawyers? Because, OK, I was talking to Glenn Kirshner a couple weeks ago for the show, and he was saying, you know, he has that new democracy pledge thing that he's doing, which is great. Asking companies to pledge not to support, or corporations not to support political candidates who don't, you know, support democracy and who are authoritarian jerks, which seems like kind of an easy ask. And I asked him kind of jokingly, have you gone to the law firms? Are you sending this to Jones Day and Kirkland Ellis or what? And he just sort of laughed and said, now we're not going to even bother. But, you know, and then Stuart Sivray, who's from Jersey, the island of Jersey, was on a couple of weeks before that. And he was saying the lawyers there are effectively just working for the oligarchs and the mob people. So do we need more regulations on the lawyers? Like, what's going on with this?
So one thing, since you just introduced Edwin Sutherland, he himself, as you know, is a sociologist, not a lawyer, but he was talking about the role of lawyers. You know, the thing is, in defense of my profession, you know, going back to what I said earlier about, you know, you can't manage what you can't measure and words matter.
Yeah.
And, you know, if you are going to convict someone of any kind of crime, our legal system requires that it to be the prosecution to prove each element of that crime beyond a reasonable doubt. And if you are a lawyer choosing to represent people who engage in behaviors on the edge of criminality, some of them will act as lobbyists or act separate, you know, some not necessarily the same exact lawyer, but people of that ilk will act as lobbyists or act to establish changes in the actual legislation so that there's sort of loopholes or it makes it harder to prove, or they will try to structure behavior so that it technically complies with a law, and or they represent somebody and they try to create doubt, right? We're seeing lawyers, if you are the defense counsel right now for what is Chauvin's first name?
Who's Derek.
Derek Chauvin. You know, that's your job, doing the disgusting work they're doing. I don't represent people, don't represent police officers who kill people in plain sight in front of the world, but people make those choices. And I understand why criminal defense lawyers do it. I think it's important for them to take on that work. The question is, if you're a corporate lawyer and you see that it's your job to change the law or manipulate the facts in a way that's perfectly legal, but it makes you feel sick to your stomach, then maybe you have to decide whether, you know, having a conscience is more important than having a yacht, you know. And I made that choice a long time ago, and I'm lucky to be able to, you know, make that choice. I had in one case a very good client when I worked in-house at Fidelity. They were an amazing client. They're a very up and up company. It's actually a family-owned business. Mm-hmm. And I was very impressed with their culture of compliance. But before that, I worked for a company. It turned right after I got out of law school, after I left a big law firm, I went in-house for a marketing company. It turns out that they were all cooking the books and several of them went to federal prison. And it was after that, and I did not know what they were doing was wrong in terms of, I didn't know anything about accounting as securities regulation at that time. But I did look back and reflect on my experience and thought, you know, they were really aggressive in their marketing. There were other signs that they were getting very close to the line at all times and had a complete disregard for the customers that they were harming in a perfectly legal way. Mm-hmm. And I just thought, well, I'm a lawyer and I see what my role is. You can choose not to represent certain types of people, right? You can choose to be on the good side. And if people did that, I think it would be better. If it became, you know, if the only kinds of lawyers bad businesses could get would be the kind of crappy lawyers that Trump got, that would be good. And speaking of lawyers, someone's writing, the guy, David Enrich, do you know him?
Yeah. Dark Towers author.
Yeah. You know, he's writing a new book about a law firm.
Oh, good. Which law firm? Or is it a secret?
No, he put it up on Twitter. I feel like it's, who's that? Is it Jones? Not Jones Day. Is Jones Day the big law firm that was representing? Who was a law firm that was always representing Trump? Where that one lawyer who had the big, when they had the big empty folders, and they said he wouldn't mix his business with his.
I know the one you mean. I don't think it's Jones Day, but I know the one. In fact, I know somebody who works there.
Send them. No, wait. What is David? Who's the name? And I can't remember what her name is. The tax lawyer who represent the. What is that law firm? At any rate. That he's doing a book on this law firm. So I think he's, I think you should really have him on, and maybe he doesn't want to talk until the book is written, but he's going to, this is like, and actually you should have him on. So you should plant in his mind the idea that he should mention that Edwin Sutherland quote and me in his new book. Because I pronounced his last name correctly. And yes, I love his book, Dark Towers.
Yeah,
and
it's really well done.
I said I'm going to be talking a lot when my book first came out, and I want to praise your book. So how do you pronounce your last name? And it's Enrich, because I didn't know if it was Enric, but it's Enrich, kind of like enrich, which is kind of perfect.
But with the syllable, with the syllable on the other,
thing. The accent on the other syllable.
But getting back to the high priced, you know, white shoe law firms and these places that have reputations as being places where oligarchs go and people with alleged mob ties and this and that. Obviously, there's vast amounts of money in this. So the choice between doing good and doing the opposite of good is not as simple as I just want to be good. It's also, like you said, you're choosing the yacht, right? And I think the problem with there seems to be a lack of regulation somehow, which now we have in the banks. Since the 08 crash, there's a lot more regulation with banking, and it's harder to launder money in the banks than it used to be, as I understand it. But in law, there doesn't seem to be this step that they need. So my analogy is in the 90s in Major League Baseball, when you had like Mark McGwire and Sammy Sosa and those guys hitting all the home runs, everybody knew that they were doing steroids, but Major League Baseball, led at the time by Bud Selig, didn't do anything about it because they wanted the revenue, they wanted the attention, and they just sort of turned a blind eye to it. And that meant that players, even the players who didn't want to cheat, felt like they had no choice. They were like, I either have to cheat to keep up with these bonzes, or I'm not going to be playing baseball anymore. And at the end of the day, when we look at baseball, it's like, I don't think this is the fault of Barry Bonds or Mark McGwire. It's the fault of Bud Selig for not enforcing the damn rules.
So where it gets complicated, though, is let's say you're working as an in-house lawyer or outside counsel for a really good company. And, you know, and there's some bad apples in it. I'm not talking about the companies that I wrote about, but it's one where there really is a mid-level person or some person with enough responsibility, but not the CEO who's doing something really bad. You want the ability to have those private conversations and stop the bad behavior and fix things. And I think that's really important. So I think that lawyers do play a role. And that's why, you know, when you talk about you're comparing banks to law firms, for your listeners, what you're talking about is our anti-money laundering laws require certain reporting.
Right.
Of suspicious transactions, and then all transactions over $10,000. And the thinking I think you're saying is, what if lawyers had to report more? Well, the Sarbanes-Oxley Act does require some type of reporting system within companies for certain types of securities fraud. I think that I wouldn't put it so much. I think that you want, I'm still someone who treasures the lawyer-client relationship because I do fear that things get worse. If you don't, I mean, the lawyers I have known in-house, say for that experience we talked about at that other firm, the lawyers I know who are in-house lawyers and the lawyers that I know who have corporate lawyers try to get their clients to do the right thing. I wasn't working in big law at the time. There was all this money laundering. And they do try to get the clients to do the right thing. And they have those relationships only because people can talk with them about a proposal and the lawyer can say, don't fucking do that. Right. And so I think that's really, really important. What I would say is the way to get at the behavior is to create better incentives and better, clearer laws to protect other types of whistleblowers inside of organizations.
Yes. Yeah. You talk about that in the book. Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, it's, you know, I think that's the way. And then I think in terms of if there's, you know, I think someone writing a book about a law firm, you know, creating a lot of law firms dropped clients because of the shame. Law firms, big law, still doesn't want to have a bad reputation because they can't recruit lawyers from law schools that are perceived to create better lawyers, right?
Interesting.
I think there are great law students everywhere, but it just so happens that when you look at a place, like Yale or Harvard or Columbia. There are going to be more students who have at that point in their life achieved a certain kind of rhetorical excellence, let's just put it that way, and fast thinking. It doesn't mean that they're the best lawyers out there, but they're a certain kind of lawyer. And if you can't recruit those lawyers to your law firm, then you're going to not be able to get as good clients and so on and so on and so on. So I think some of the pressure on these firms has worked. And that's why some of them dropped, even mid-sized firms, that's why some of them dropped Trump as a client, because they didn't want to have reputational damage.
That's just so something that we can do, like people on Twitter can do, is shame law firms that, for example, represent shady Russian oligarchs. That's good. That's good to know that, yeah, that makes a difference.
It worked recently right around the, it was right around the time of the second impeachment. Can you believe that there was a second impeachment?
Well, there are two Godfather movies. I guess there's more than one two Godfather movies, but only two that.
The good ones.
Yeah. Two that we recognize. Yeah. No, it's just as a pause, when you go back and think about what has happened in the last 4 years, it really is just crazy, right? I mean, between the impeachments and the crime and the pandemic and...
I mean, this thing jumped the shark so long ago. And to me, the psychological, you know, there's the dark psychological impact and there's the pain and suffering. And then there's the sort of the analysis you do of your own mind where you go, it's very hard to slow your mind down for a moment and realize this is all real. Because the fact that, like, right now, I'm talking to you on a fucking screen of my computer.
I know.
On a stack of books, right? Like, and around me is like a clutter of other shit that you can't see because I just have this in the frame. I mean, and I know that you're just listening to the podcast, right? And it all seems very normal, but everything is still really not normal. And so I want to make an analogy to this in white collar crime. The world in which we are living in, at least we remember the before times. And at least we're getting close enough to the after times. But the fear I had if Trump were reelected is that would fade. It's like the Machiavelli thing. I remember reading Machiavelli in middle school or something. And maybe this one we also were assigned Ayn Rand or something. And
middle school assigned Ayn Rand? Oh, dear. Okay.
Yeah, that was the one libertarian at this kind of edgy, artsy, left-wing prep school, but you can understand. And... you know, this idea that if you just crush people generation after generation, they won't remember. That's kind of, you know, and I was just so afraid of that. But we know the before times. We imagine a world where it would be less authoritarian than Trump. We imagine a world where we went outside without masks on. We can do this. But we cannot imagine a world where white-collar criminals don't get away with it. It's too long ago for people. I mentioned those times when there were crackdowns in the book, but it's so the norm that people with money and power and privilege, mostly who are white, do not encounter legal consequences for their unlawful behavior, especially when it comes to fraud, if they have enough institutional support. It's just so much part of who we are that we don't even expect it. And even getting people to think that there could be a before time or there could be an after time is part of my project.
That's interesting. That's a really good way of thinking about it. I just want to say for the listeners that your Room Raider rating should be very high. You have a nice kind of like autumnal orange paint job with a nice bookcase going on in the background. I approve. It's
and these are my maternal grandmother's teacups here that I'm drinking.
But you're right. It's like, it's almost waiting for the Zoom meeting to start is like Star Trek, where it's just all of a sudden people materialize on the planet. You're like, where the fuck did he come from? He was before there was nothing. And now everybody is here and about. And
If you're going to talk about, I just have to say, Greg, what is on over your left shoulder? You've got some sort of action figure type things on the show.
Oh, I have, first of all, let's do a little show and tell. I have, this is the Pietà, which I don't have good lighting right now.
I love that.
And I have it because my grandfather had one.
Oh.
So when I went to Rome, I bought one. This is my Nancy Pelosi candle. My friend sent me. And this is a action figure of the Hulk. And I don't know what, this just appeared in the garage one day. So I don't know. I don't know where it came from. I don't know whose it is, but it's now in my office.
That's awesome.
For better or worse. So I think we should end this on an upswing. I think we're now, as we're recording this, we're about almost 100 days into Biden-Harris. I said the other night, I did a live show, and I said, I think Biden is already the best president of my lifetime. And my son was outside the door, and he's like, no, he's not, just because he's a wise ass. But what's your thinking about this, and especially as it relates to the topic of the day, which is white-collar crime? Has he done anything yet to make this better?
I love that you're asking that, because the preface to the paperback edition begins with kind of that question. And I don't want to read from it, but I'll say that Lisa Monaco is the person Biden has selected to be the deputy attorney general. That's the person who would be right below Merrick Garland. Mm-hmm. Lisa Monaco won the highest award the Department of Justice confers on anyone for her role prosecuting executives from Enron. End of story. No, beginning of story.
Also, Glenn Kirshner loves her. He was raving about her. So
everybody I know who loves her. So I would love, it would be my dream to meet with her and call her boss, but I don't know if that will ever happen.
Oh, I know what I wanted to say before. We were talking about how the white collar criminals who get off tend to be white men, but also they tend to be men. If we think of, if you there listening now, think of someone famous who got arrested for insider trading. It's Martha Stewart. That's who it is. It's like the one woman.
Stop. Yes, she's a white woman, but she was not actually arrested for insider trading. It turns out.
I was lying to the, I know it's in the book, but still. The perception is that she was.
And Leona Helmsley
for
tax fraud. Yeah, no, it's true.
Yeah.
And the only banker who was prosecuted, bringing this back full circle, the only executive in the U.S. who was prosecuted, bank executive prosecuted for the, related to the mortgage fraud in 2008 was Kareem Sarah-Geldon. And he was an American who was not actually born in the U.S., who was from Egypt, grew up in Michigan, and was living, I think, in London, working for a non-U.S. bank, and has a Middle Eastern-sounding name. So even when it comes to white-collar crime, there has been, sadly, a tendency to avoid the people who are more likely, this is known statistically, to commit white-collar crime, which happen to be white, wealthy males.
Yeah. Well, this has been such a, I was really looking forward to this, and it did not disappoint. Your book is Big Dirty Money, The Shocking Injustice and Unseen Cost of White Collar Crime. It's coming out in paperback, what, in June, you said?
Right, that's the plot, with a new cover.
With a new cover and with a new epilogue. So go order.
And there's going to be a new foreword to it too, yep.
So go order it now online. We'll put the link on the page here. So Jennifer, thank you so much for taking the time. It's great to meet you.
Thank you. Great to meet you too.
Prevail theme song is by Matthew Fassa. Sofia Tereshchenko provided the Russian voiceover. Thanks to Stephanie St. John for the narration. Thanks to Allison Gill, Jason Smith, Mackenzie Mizell, and everyone else involved with producing this podcast. Please subscribe to the Prevail website. Visit gregoliar.com. That's GREGOLEAR.com. Until next time, we shall prevail.
Are you struggling to lower your bad LDL cholesterol, even though you may be taking a statin, swapping steaks for salads, and exercising while listening to this podcast? Ask your doctor if Repatha Evolocumab is right for you. With Repatha, you can dramatically reduce bad cholesterol and the risk of another heart attack while enjoying life too, because you're human. And with convenient self-administration, you can take Repatha in the comfort of your own home. Do not take Repatha if you're allergic to it. Repatha can cause serious allergic reactions. Signs include trouble breathing or swallowing, or swelling of the face. Most common side effects include runny nose, sore throat, common cold symptoms, flu or flu-like symptoms, back pain, high blood sugar and redness, pain, or bruising at the injection site. Visit Repatha.com or call 1-844-REPATHA. Talk to your doctor today about Repatha.